experiences from that point of view. There are many layers of what is going on. It takes Charles Kay a year to organise this. There's an enormous amount in the background to make something like this happen.
Monica, what did it mean to you personally to play in this orchestra?
I felt like I was really representing my orchestra, my colleagues from my orchestra, and my country in a peaceful and musical gesture.
But the concerts, Monica, I mean, the experience of playing those concerts, sitting as you were with the leader of the second violins of the Vienna Philharmonic next to you, the concerts themselves were special experiences.
It was like getting run over by a locomotive. The amount of sound that I heard was just phenomenal because it was so committed. And like Ed said, nobody's getting paid somehow. So it was just like back in the youth orchestra days, the level of enthusiasm, it was just infectious and quite overwhelming. In fact, I left the Krakow concert in tears and I just had to choke them back on the first page of Mahler because Mahler's my favourite thing anyway. It was all incredibly overwhelming. And to have Gergiev, who I've always just thought was an incredible musician, and I couldn't believe I was in the same room as him, let alone underneath his nose.
Ed, playing in the LSO, London Symphony Orchestra, as you do, it's your day job. Still, this experience is special.
It is indeed, yes. And the level of commitment and enthusiasm that you get in the World Orchestra for Peace is extraordinary and a privilege. It really is a privilege to be part of that ensemble.
Ed van der Spar and Monica Currow. Having given only 14 concerts in its entire history, is it possible to talk of a World Orchestra for Peace sound, a particular approach and intensity the players and Gergiev bring to their music-making that you can't find in any other day-to-day orchestra? Well, the two people who've nurtured every World Orchestra for Peace concert should know, Valerie Schulte and Charles Kay.
Our listening public will hear it. All the players since the first concert wanted to be the best. There's an electricity that you don't get in a standard orchestra that plays together the whole time. That, I think, what sets us apart.
I take every concert as it is. I don't think one should compare. You know, like a wonderful garden. You don't say I like roses better than peonies or bluebells better than forget-me-nots. All orchestras, all ensembles are remarkable. Music is such a wonderful thing. It never fails you in your life. But with this orchestra, I'm very partisan. I'm not objective about it. I'm very subjective about it. My husband would be so thrilled that it was going on, that it was continuing.
Music cannot be done in a war condition. Music emphasizes peace. Music emphasizes good fortune of the humans, that you can have music. What a wonderful gift God is that one. You can't do music with cannons shooting and burning cities down, which we unfortunately having all the time, today as well, while we're making this music all around in Europe, not all around, in a certain part of Europe, is war, desperate civilian killings going on. And we just look at the television every evening. We don't do anything. The only thing which I'm doing, and my colleagues, when I ask them, nearly 100 people, yes, we want to come. We want to demonstrate for peace. I think this is wonderful.
Sir George Schulte with words as true today as they were back in 1995. This evening's interval was presented by Tom Service and produced by Ruth Thompson. And I should tell you that there was a special ceremony in the Royal Albert Hall this morning during the rehearsal break when UNESCO's Director General Irina Bokova took to the podium to honour the orchestra as an official UNESCO Artist for Peace, saying that each member of the orchestra represents the universal desire to spread cultural diversity, intercultural dialogue and a culture of peace. Well, you'll find that the orchestra's grown a little since the first half. In the second part of this evening's prom from the Royal Albert Hall and live here on BBC Radio 3, Valery Gergiev from the World Orchestra for Peace introduces to Mahler's New World of his Fifth Symphony. And it may only be a year later, but after the classical simplicity of the fourth, quite a lot has changed. Mahler had a summer retreat built in the alpine village of Majernig, a lakeside house with a composing hut up the hill. And in the summer of 1901, he started work on the fifth. That winter, he met the woman who changed his life, the passionate, tempestuous Alma Schindler, 22 years old, more or less half Mahler's age. Within weeks, they were engaged, within months, they were married, and Alma was expecting their first child, and her new husband was finishing the symphony he'd begun the previous summer. You'd expect Mahler's music in the Fifth to reflect the emotional turmoil and the intensity of his new relationship, and in many ways it does. It's a journey from darkness to light, from funeral march to life-affirming finale, with a famous slow movement that's a love song to Alma. It may be Mahler at his happiest, producing some of his most radiant music, but there are still fears and terrors. A year earlier, just before he'd met Alma, Mahler had lived through a near-death experience, suffering a hemorrhage brought on in part by his punishing schedule as a conductor. So, even as he found a new future opening up to him, Mahler must have harboured fears of his own mortality. We're lucky to be able to experience this musical turning point in Mahler's cycle of symphonies in a single concert. Even for this orchestra, it makes for a demanding evening. Here's Valery Gergiev.
It's a very brave program, but I find it interesting. I can even say we find it interesting. I didn't hear one complaint about why we play two symphonies. There is a huge difference. And of course, to find this easy, elegant touch with the Fourth Symphony and then move to the somewhat tragic, dramatic world of the Fifth Symphony from the beginning and then to the incredible power of the final statement of this Fifth Symphony, which in no way is tragic or sad. I think it's a huge development from the beginning of the Fourth Symphony to the end of the Fifth, and this is the distance we want to cover.
The Fifth Symphony begins with a funeral march. There seems to be no escape from death and darkness, at least not here. There's a savage drive to the second movement, but also the occasional glimpse of optimism, even hope, in a brass chorale, although we're still left in shadow at the end. The third movement is a scherzo that's almost a kind of crazy Viennese waltz with dialogues between solo horn and strings. As he rehearsed for the first performance in Cologne in 1904, Mahler wondered out loud in a letter to Alma what audiences would make of what he called these primeval noises, this rushing, roaring, raging sea, these dancing stars, these ebbing, shimmering, gleaming waves. And then comes the great Adagietto, Mahler's love song to Alma before the impact of the finale, and at last the brass chorale from the second movement does break through, a blazing explosion of light and optimism to balance the darkness that came before. Well, all the Orchestra for World Peace principles have changed around for this second Mahler symphony, with the exception of this evening's leader, Rainer Küchel, the Vienna Philharmonic's concertmeister. But it's such a versatile orchestra. They're all principles. They can play in any position, the string players. So many leaders of orchestras around the world just in the first violins. Either way, the first complete Proms performance of Mahler 5 wasn't until 1968 with Pierre Boulez and the BBC Symphony Orchestra. That's the kind of thing you can find out for yourself if you explore the newly launched Proms database online with searchable details of all Proms performances. bbc.co.uk/proms/archive if you'd like to have a look. And here comes Valery Gergiev, Sir George Schulte's successor at the helm of his brainchild, the World Orchestra for Peace, to conduct Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 5. And after the fourth, the orchestra's trombones and tuba are reinstated. Thank you.
Thank you.
Darkness Banished at the end of Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 5, and a new symphonic journey embarked on, which was to unfold over another 4 completed symphonies. That's Lied von der Erde and an unfinished 10th symphony. You've just heard Mahler 5 performed by the World Orchestra for Peace, conducted by its founder, Sir George Scholte's successor, Valery Gergiev. No baton, not even the little white minimalist toothpick that has become so familiar, just his hands fluttering feverishly as he coaxes the best from this formidable ensemble. You've already heard cheers as he brought some of the soloists from the orchestra to their feet straight after the end of the symphony. Right at the start, solo trumpet of Timur Martinov from Gergiev's own Mariinsky Theatre Orchestra in St. Petersburg. And the horn soloist, duetting with the strings and her own muted echo in the third movement, was Gail Williams, ex-Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Some great horn playing all round, as we heard. And in the Adagietto of the symphony, harpist Valerie Aldrich Smith from a little closer to home, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. Yeah, get back on the platform. The orchestra on its feet, gesturing his appreciation to all of them and bowing to the audience here in the Royal Albert Hall. The principal flautist in Mahler 5 was Jeffrey Kahner from the Philadelphia Orchestra. Highly distinctive sound from him. And there are principals from the Chicago and Montreal Symphony Orchestras, the Metropolitan Opera in New York, Minnesota, the Concertgebouw, the Vienna and Berlin Philharmonics. And that includes one of the Brits from the Berlin Phil, horn player Sarah Willis. She was talking to me earlier about how extraordinary it is to be with such a mixture of players, traditions and instruments just in her own section. And that applause and cheer for Gail Williams once again, principal horn player. Now the whole horn section standing to acknowledge the applause. On paper, Sarah was telling me it doesn't look like it's going to work, but they listen and blend. More cheers for solo trumpeter Timur Martinov again. What next? Well, they're only playing 2 concerts this season. They're taking these 2 Mahler symphonies to the Salzburg Festival tomorrow. But Gergiev did tell me that for the first time, it might not be a year or more before they get together again. He says there are moves afoot to reform the orchestra in around 6 months' time, but where and for what, you wouldn't say. Jeffrey Kahner and the rest of the flute section getting their share of the applause. Oboes, four bassoons, the winds all in turn. By the way, if you'd like to see the World Orchestra for Peace for yourself, then you can, as BBC Television's been filming this program. You can see Mahler 5 this Saturday evening on BBC 2, starting at 8:10, with Mahler 4 following on the red button. The Proms Mahler anniversary season continues next Tuesday the 10th, with Ingo Metzmacher conducting the 7th symphony. And it's not the last we've seen of Valery Gergiev this season either. He's back on the 16th to conduct the London Symphony Orchestra in Scriabin and Stravinsky. And tomorrow night's prom brings music by Mahler's friend and occasional rival Richard Strauss, A Hero's Life, with Sir Mark Elder conducting the Halle, and Paul Lewis in the next instalment of his cycle of Beethoven piano concertos, the 3rd. But as the audience, the prommers, stamp their approval here in the Albert Hall, what sounds we've heard tonight from Sir George Scholte's ambassadors for world peace. Musicians showing, he said, the politicians what can be achieved with an ideal of international harmony. And as Valery Gergiev returns to the platform, let's wish them well as they head for the Salzburg Festival tomorrow. And back in Broadcasting House, where politics is never allowed to get in the way of music, here's Jill Anderson.
How true. Andrew, thank you very much. That was Andrew McGregor at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom again here on Radio 3 on Tuesday afternoon at 2 o'clock. If you'd like to submit a review of tonight's prom, then you can visit the prom's website, bbc.co.uk/proms, and click on Share.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer proms season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Well, next this evening, the story of the court architect to the Ottoman Empire in the 16th century. That's in a few minutes' time. Till then, here's piano music by Debussy. Pascal Roger plays the Arabesque No. 1. Debussy's Arabesque No. 1. It was played by Pascal Roger. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 17 minutes past 10. And now a second chance to hear Sinan the Magnificent, first broadcast in February this year. It's presented by the architecture correspondent and Guardian writer, Jonathan Glancy.
His powers were so great, and the number of buildings he created was so prodigious, that he was said to fly like some mythical hero from one construction site to another. A contemporary of Michelangelo, whose work he influenced, he was a brilliant soldier who fought to extend the Ottoman Empire, later court architect to one of the most powerful men the world has known, the ruler of lands across the Balkans and North Africa to the Middle East. Over half a century, he shaped some 500 of the most magnificent, inventive, and sublime buildings of all time. And yet, he is virtually unknown in the West. This is his extraordinary story.
Sinan was at the centre of one of the most powerful ruling elites the world has ever known, the Ottoman Empire in the 16th century.
He would have seen the city from across the Bosphorus. It was a city of domes that had no comparisons in the West.
He took this mosque as a challenge to him and to his art.
Istanbul, formerly Constantinople, is today one of the world's fastest growing cities. It's always been a cradle of ambitious cultures, a voluptuous trading post, a legendary prize to be dreamt of and fought over. Founded by the Roman Emperor Constantine in the early 4th century, the heart of the Byzantine Empire until it was conquered by the Ottomans over 1,000 years later. It was here in the 16th century, during the 46-year reign of Suleiman the Magnificent, that the Islamic Ottoman Empire reached the zenith of its power and influence. Sinan, as the court's chief architect, was called upon to display the architectural magnificence and munificence of an empire long seen as both terrifying and exquisite. But Sinan was born an outsider, not an Ottoman or even a Muslim. He was recruited into imperial service as part of the Janissary Corps, a body of the brightest and toughest new or young soldiers. As Rory Algeito, a journalist with the Architects Journal, who has a passion for Sinan's work, explains.
Sinan was inducted into Ottoman culture under something called the Devşirme, which was a levy system organised by the Ottomans on the Christian peoples of the empire, in which the most able youths from Christian communities were taken, converted to Islam, and used as soldiers, administrators, scientists, engineers, slave soldiers devoted to the Sultan. And they conquered half of Europe and all of Arabia and the North African coast for the Ottoman Empire. And Sinan was one of these soldiers before he became an architect.
So he actually fought?
Yes. I mean, famously, he fought in the campaign for Rhodes, which was undertaken by Suleiman the Magnificent in the 1520s. And when Rhodes was captured, the booty for Rhodes would eventually pay for Suleiman's mosque, which was designed by Sinan.
When he starts off, do you think he had some sort of architectural, you know, vision that was growing in him? Or was it purely because he was a young man that plugged into these mighty emperors at the right time?
I think we can assume that Sinan has always had an interest in architecture. He comes from ancient crumbling Anatolia, a village called Agirnes near the town of Kayseri. And we know that there was a quarry, for example. The area where he grew up was littered with Seljuk and post-Seljuk monuments. And there is a suspicion that he may have come from an Armenian background, with Armenians traditionally being stonecutters and architects.
Sinan's experiences as a Janissary during the Ottoman military campaigns were to stand him in good stead. In the instance of war, he learned how to build rapidly, effectively and well. Siege engines, catapults, bridges, camps, fortifications.
Although a shadowy figure on a personal level, we're lucky to know something of Sinan's views on his career and achievements through a verse biography of the architect written, with help no doubt from Sinan himself, by a poet friend, Mustafa Sai Chelebi.
If there were no architect to build a world, with stone alone no wall could be made. Above all, a wise architect such as this, a master engineer, pious and without defect, Sinan of Kayseri is his celebrated name.
He actually mentions in his biography that he was lucky enough to see a huge part of the world in his travels as a soldier, and he actually talks about taking refuge in the ruins of ancient structures which he much admired.
His inspired and diligent efforts on these ambitious campaigns brought Sinan, soon enough, to the attention of the Sultan.
He was asked by his senior officer during a campaign in Moldavia to build a bridge across some marshland. Now, on completion of the bridge, his senior said, "Now we must build a tower in order to defend it." Sinan decided to contradict his senior, however, and said, no, we'll knock it down. We can rebuild this bridge when we return." You know, he was worried that this was seen as a slight against his commander and would come to haunt him later on. But his commander realised his kind of wise advice, and that same commander would go on to become the Grand Vizier and eventually appoint Sinan as chief architect.
It was true that the thought of abandoning my career as a Janissary gave me pain. But in the end, I accepted, seeing it as an opportunity to build many mosques and thereby fulfill many desires in this world and the next.
And so Sinan came to Istanbul as chief architect to the court of Suleiman the Magnificent. Istanbul was a place he had first come to live as a young Janissary, newly inducted in imperial service. I asked Alessandra Ricci, a Byzantine historian at Istanbul's Koç University, what impact the imperial city might have made on the newly appointed architect.
Well, first of all, he was coming from Anatolia, so he was coming from the east. And he would have seen the city from across the Bosphorus. And at that point in time, Istanbul / Constantinople was a city of domes that had no comparisons in the West.
Visiting Sinan's buildings, it is hard not to feel that he was obsessed by the dome structures already in the city and wanted to use and extend the form. Not just with the astonishing singular domes crowning the prayer halls of his mosques, but all the many lesser domes dancing attendance on them. Domes covering the hot rooms, cold baths, plunge pools of bathhouses. Domes embracing the classrooms of madrasas or religious schools. Domes wherever an uneventful flat roof might appear today. Constantinople had come under Ottoman rule in 1453, when the Christian city was seized by Mehmet the Conqueror, a Sunni Muslim, in an act of carnage, the bloody slaughter of many of its long-besieged citizens. That, just as strikingly, led to the establishment of a centre of opulent Ottoman civilization. Mehmet was fierce, yet willing to be cultured. He much appreciated the sending, by the Venetian Republic, of the artist Gentile Bellini to paint portraits of his court in 1479. Knowledge of Italian art and architecture began to play their part.
We know that when Mehmet II had his tents outside the city walls of Constantinople, waiting for the right moment to get into the city, he had small circles of humanists who educated him to the history of the city, exposed him to both the Greek and Latin languages in a way in which it kind of demonstrates to us his full intentions of building up an awareness about the very historic event he was about to be the main participant of.
Sinan's period of office as the empire's chief architect, from 1539 to his death in 1588, witnessed the transformation of pure military expansionism by the Ottomans into an official nurturing of cities, public works, architecture, culture and civil life designed to outshine those of Byzantine Constantinople and even to rival the glories of ancient Rome. Suleiman enjoyed many titles, Slave of God, Sultan of all sultans in all the lands of Persians and Arabs, and Caesar of all the lands of Rome. He tried, but never conquered these. He would often refer to himself simply, if emphatically, as Caesar. When I first came to Istanbul and stared from the centre of the Galata Bridge at the city's imperious skyline, its dense, shadowy streets and impetuous bustle, I couldn't help thinking, so this is what ancient Rome must have been like. It felt more like Rome, the Rome of the Caesars, than Rome itself. And of course Constantinople, and by extension Istanbul, was the successor to the Rome of the Caesars. Small wonder then that Suleiman, a dynamic imperialist, dreamt of being a Caesar too. He planned to reunite Rome and Istanbul through military conquest. In Istanbul itself, he would found a new Rome, and Sinan would be his most ardent agent in this ambitious task.
This is the heart of the Shahadi Magnet Mosque. It's one of the most magnificent buildings you can imagine. This is the building that Suleiman Magnificent commissioned from Sinan when Sinan was almost newly appointed as chief architect for the empire. And he built in memory of the Sultan's beloved son Mehmet, who died very young at about the age of 21. And what an honour the Sultan created for his son. More importantly, of course, for Sinan, this was the building that made his name. It's a revolutionary building. It's the first of a new type of mosque where the one great single space of this prayer hall is centralised, gathered together under a beautiful floating saucer dome high above me, rich in decoration, punctured by great arched windows, and lit below by hundreds and hundreds of lamps over the carpeted floor. As soon as you walk into this building, you think, well, this is truly magnificent. It's the work of a great, great architect. From this moment on, Sinan's name was made.
The mosque you just said you visited today, Shehzade, that building remained the model for each sultanic, each royal mosque that was built by the Ottomans into the later 18th century.
Çiğdem Kafesciolu, from Istanbul's Boğaziçi University.
Sinan never built a structure that was, you know, exactly, that had exactly the same plan and layout as the Şehzade. He never went back to that, but the much famed Sultanahmet, the so-called Blue Mosque, the Yeni Cami in Eminönü, which was also built by a woman, that is the royal mosque in the Quay area, and so on. Each of these buildings refer to the Şehzade.
Sinan's evidently profound understanding of mathematics and the possibilities of geometry, together with his practical knowledge of construction, enabled him to push architecture to greater heights and depths for his new patron, Rory Ojaito.
We know that books on applied geometry were regularly read by the corps of royal architects, and you know, this would have been one of the main sources of understanding how to build. I think the most important thing for Sinan was to basically create spatial unity under one crowning dome. And the idea would be that you're creating a paradise-like realm on Earth in which the sky seemed to be floating above you and there's no visible means of support.
He was able to learn from the great Byzantine basilicas dating back nearly 1,000 years and to push the ideas and structures of these further. I can imagine him walking under the dome of the 6th century Hagia Sophia Basilica and thinking, how did they do that? And how does this structure work?
The main contrast between Sinan's mosques and Hagia Sophia, against which it's so often compared, is the sheer amount of light that exists within them. There's a degree of understanding of how much stone is actually needed within a wall in order to support a roof. And this is because of the greater structural knowledge that Sinan had of what was achievable. So he was quite happy to punch holes into the walls which were supporting the domes in order to bring much more light into the structure, just because of that greater understanding of how stone and masonry can perform.
We'll come back to the cultural importance of the Hagia Sophia later in the programme. Sinan's greatest mosque complex would come much later, with the building of the sublime Selamiye at Edirne in the west of modern Turkey and the Süleymaniye Mosque in the centre of Istanbul. Mosques were undoubtedly the crowning glory of Sinan's long career, yet he was also in charge of the Public Works Department, building the massive physical infrastructure that made for an empire of wealth as well as one of power and show. By contemporary standards, Sinan ran a vast office or workshop, producing standard designs for mosques, fortresses, bridges and other engineering structures that could be reproduced at his insistence to a high calibre across the empire. These designs were sent by messengers or carried by Sinan's assistants, following busy trade routes, each provided with places to rest a day's ride from the next. Here's a lovely surprise. I've just come away from the tram stop at the end of Galata Bridge, which is very much one of the hubs of modern Istanbul, and I'm walking along a narrow alley through the rusting, creaking, hulking gates of a very special place. This is the Rustem Pasha Caravanserai. Caravanserai, it's a hotel really for merchants and traders, designed and built by Sinan in the 1540s. It's a long, long, long open-air courtyard, and all around the courtyard are galleries with rooms above, fronted by big pointed arches, a great arcade running right round the top. I suppose it looks like a piece of a medieval castle to European eyes. It's a remarkable place today. It's not full of camels and merchants and their merchandise. It's full of, well, sort of DIY workshops, men selling machine tools, bits of timber, screws, planks, nails, anything you want really for building. Still very much in use. I was joined at the caravanserai by Ebru Boyar from the Middle East Technical University, Ankara, who has studied and written about the everyday life of the Ottomans. Ebru, let's try and imagine this caravanserai in its original heyday at the time of Sinan. What would it have been like?
Mainly for merchants, for trade. But of course, there are also travellers who were coming to the Ottoman Empire for different purposes. And what was interesting about the caravanserais, they were providing lodging for the traders and their animals, but also they provide security. That's essentially very important. When you look at the Selim I, his law book, you can see that there are strict regulations about security in caravanserai. So this is not simply a place for lodging, but the people, the traders, can put their goods in safe hands, and that is important. Lodging, feeding your animals, and keeping your goods in safe hands, they will keep the animals under the...
The arcade below,
yeah, in the first floors. But there, I think I saw this description from Schweiger, who was a traveler, German priest, actually accompanied the Habsburg ambassador then, again in the 16th century. He depicts the caravanserai, the traders or the guests stay with their animals in the same place. I don't know, but the idea was that the animals were kept downstairs and the people slept in the rooms and they shared the rooms. So therefore it explains why the security is important, of course.
And we were to discover something new about the historic structure when we asked one of the workmen here if he knew who had built the caravanserai.
Kurşunlar ismini almış. Eskiden burada sobacılar falan vardı.
He said that this is from Byzantine period. The local population is very well informed because the university students are coming with their professors here and they are giving lectures here. So they are hearing all this information. What he said that this building is actually, the basement is a Byzantine. And on top of it, they Mimar Sinan edit things. And there's a church, he said, just by.
Is it here, down here, the church?
And indeed, inaccessible on foot, there were the ruins of what might well be, or could have been, a church tower.
Sinan clearly rebuilt this.
Yes, I think they added things. Probably the basement might have been from the Byzantine, but obviously you can see the later additions.
So it just looks as if Sinan must have built up either on the foundations of an old church, a Byzantine church, or the church was demolished and then rebuilt.
Yes, but I have to say that is what he heard from the...
Despite a certain amount of willful or selective destruction, the Ottomans made a point of building on the foundations of the Roman city. When they breached the walls of Byzantine Constantinople, they took lives, yet spared much of the architecture.
What was done, perhaps, in Constantinople is both appropriation and rejection, in a way. Appropriation of some of the very vital, very central symbols of the Byzantine city, Hagia Sophia being the major one. But also, at times, demolition of certain equally symbolic monuments, or neglect and sort of eventual destruction of others, such as the palaces of the Byzantine city.
Tourists and local people now have to pass through airport-style security gates on their way inside the compelling and cavernous architectural glories of the Hagia Sophia, the Roman Emperor Justinian's crowning legacy. "Solomon, I have outdone you," he is said to have exclaimed when this unprecedented domed basilica was first completed in 537. He was thinking of King Solomon's mighty Temple of Jerusalem. Under the Ottomans, this Christian basilica became a mosque. Its grandeur attracted and haunted the new conquerors. Ebru Boyar.
They added minarets, of course. First two, and then later two of those are added by Sinan himself.
Do we know, or do we have any record or evidence that the Ottomans did have this instant respect for this great building, the Hagia Sophia?
When Mehmed II came to city, of course, that is an Ottoman tradition to have the Friday sermon and then a khutbah, a kind of a prayer would be read in the name of the Sultan. So therefore, Mehmed chose, inevitably, this church and converted it into mosque and made him actually the imperial mosque, the biggest mosque in the empire. So from this perspective, I think it shows the respect to the building and the respect to the legacy of the Byzantine. But of course also, it's also kind of giving a message to the Christian world that, look, you got this. I mean, that is important, I think, from this perspective. I think Mehmed was very aware of the value of the building.
Mehmed, Suleiman's predecessor, had reshaped Hagia Sophia as a place for Muslim worship. Yet Suleiman himself was determined to build a new imperial mosque that would outdo both Solomon and Justinian.
One morning, the idea of setting about the construction of an exalted Friday mosque entered the noble, auspicious heart of that son of knowledge and beloved of the hearts of men and jinns, His Majesty, the fortunate Padishah, the late and forgiven Sultan Suleiman Khan, son of Selim Khan. May God's mercy and pardon be upon him. He summoned his servant, this weak slave, the architect Sinan, son of Abdul Menan, to consult about the noble mosque, and the design of the building was settled upon and its location determined.
Rising up before me is the sheer magnificence of the Suleymaniye Mosque. This is the greatest of Sinan's buildings in Istanbul, and indeed, quite simply, one of the greatest buildings of the Renaissance period. Minarets, dome, of course, and wonderful gardens that this is all set in. This is a whole piece of city, a great oasis of streets and outbuildings surrounding the mosque, right in the centre of Istanbul, a place to come and escape. Philip Mansell is author of Constantinople, City of the World's Desire. And Philip, what would the Suleymaniye complex have looked and felt like soon after it was completed in 1557?
Yes, it would have been full of people. The imaret, the soup kitchen in one of the outer buildings, schools for children to learn the Quran, worshippers going in and out. it would have been one of the great centres of the city, a meeting place as well as a place of worship. And a school. Only colourful if a vizier or a sultan or a member of the imperial family came to pray. They had the most brightly coloured robes. Ordinary people were much less colourfully dressed. I think they would have been like the two gentlemen there.
Interesting, two gentlemen walking past in a... Yes, how would I describe that? Those very traditional religious garb.
Baggy trousers and a skull cap.
The superficial image we often have of the Ottoman Empire is one shaded with capricious cruelty, of over-imaginative executions, poisonings, intrigues, and exotic harems where no woman was ever truly safe. And yet, the beautiful soup kitchens, schools, public baths, drinking fountains, and paradisical gardens you can see here at the Süleymaniye Mosque and elsewhere in Istanbul suggest that they could also be civil and very civic-minded. And I need to remind myself that for all these intrigues, Sinan survived in office through a number of regime changes, and he appears never to have been threatened with dismissal or anything worse. Of course, these civilized gestures, the soup kitchens, fountains and so on, were also ways of drawing together the extremely disparate members of the far-reaching Ottoman Empire, Jews and Christians included, of whom Sinan had once been one himself, as Alessandra Ricci explains.
These were people whose territorial control spanned from the Balkans into the Middle East. So rather than divide and conquer, they created these very elaborate networks of social support. And when you go to the Süleymaniye, you have the feeling that it entire neighborhood rotates around a world of its own. You know, hospices, soup kitchen, and, you know, dynastic burials, and a main religious building.
These look back to the ways of the Byzantine city and, in turn, to ancient Rome. As an architect, Sinan was well aware of the ways in which the Romans had built and ordered towns, cities, and monumental building complexes. As a soldier with the Emperor's armies, he had seen and used these for himself. He had even been to Apulia in southern Italy in 1507 with an Ottoman expeditionary force. Equally, it seems possible that he kept up to date with at least some of the latest developments in Renaissance Italy, as architects and their patrons rediscovered their Roman legacy and began to emulate and even to try and surpass it. He certainly knew of Michelangelo's dome soaring